basically sort of treated them like pets. And they named them and started sharing food with them and that kind of thing. And they did this, you know, probably
out of loneliness or boredom in the
Partly. I think this was, you know, I mean, a lot of coal miners in that part of the world had sort of agricultural backgrounds, and I think they were sort of used to having animals in their lives, and so having other living creatures in the mines did sort of, you know, fulfill emotional needs. But at the same time, these mice actually fulfilled roles similar to canaries in coal mines. So mice had two advantages. One is that mice are really sensitive to the sort of micro cracking that would precede larger falls of coal from the roof or from the face in the mines. And so so miners, you know, they enjoyed these mice, but they also kept their eyes on them as they were working. If the mice scurried away, that was bad. The other thing that these mice were very sensitive to, of course, was carbon monoxide. And so if you were working in an underground chamber and the mice in there keeled over, it was one of the only ways in which these miners could actually tell that there was carbon monoxide creeping into their rooms.
They had less affectionate relationship with the mules.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The relationships between drivers and mules were very contentious. And, you know, and there's the whole sort of story of back and forth. You know, I mean, these mules really were famously stubborn, and the men who had to work with them all day often had their hands full. But at the same time, you know, I mean, they would sort of have their favorites and would develop quite affectionate relationships with some mules. But then they compared other mules sometimes to, you know, one mine worker called them bulky women. And in one of the most interesting interviews, a miner said that the mules were unionized before we were. And so there was this sort of sense then that the mules had kind of human-like qualities. And so, it was really that section of Killing for Coal that got me thinking about human-animal relationships in different ways. And so, you know, I did what a lot of professors do when we see a little piece of something that intrigues us in our research. I developed a course, a seminar class on animals in American history. And it was in teaching that class that I saw the need for a book like the one I'm currently writing.
And your tale of the miners really kind of capsulizes what is our sort of dichotomous relationship with animals. There are animals we love and animals we eat.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, there's so much richness and so much contradiction. Just sort of the whole range of human emotions and human capabilities, I think, are really, animals provide an ideal lens for thinking about these things across time.
When I think of animals in history in the West, anyway, I think iconic animals come immediately to mind: bison, wolves, mm-hmm. cattle, sheep.
Yeah, absolutely. And, these iconic creatures, most of which are kind of, you know, fall into the category of charismatic megafauna. Not all of them, but most of them are charismatic megafauna. Those are certainly the easiest animals to research as a historian. And those are, you know, those creatures are going to be the main focus in this animal's history of the United States that I'm working on. But one of the things that I'm trying to do in the book is to think across the different kinds of categories that we humans impose upon animals. So to think about livestock and pets together, to think about working animals and companion animals and laboratory subjects. And so, you know, I mean, there's actually this sort of burgeoning field of animal studies and quite a lot of historical work on human-animal relationships, but a lot of it's been really narrow in terms of, you know, focusing on particular species or particular kinds of uses. And so, you know, I'm trying to kind of think outside the box and look at the larger connections and the mm-hmm. larger sets of relationships.
And are you looking at humans' effect on animals or the other, animals' effect on humans?
Both. I mean, yeah, that's what really, you know, as an environmental historian and, environmental history is really a field about relationships and about reciprocal relationships. And so I'm interested in how these effects work in both directions. And create, you know, sort of unexpected processes of change. So, in the case of something like horses, if you pick a, you know, very iconic creature in terms of Native American history. Horses enable Native peoples in the 1600s and 1700s into the 1800s to revolutionize their lives in all sorts of important ways. But then the, you know, Indian use of horses then has all sorts of impacts on the horses themselves, from the creation of new breeds like the Appaloosa to the development of new economic relationships. Horses become sort of part of networks where captives and slaves are changing hands. These relationships are always working both ways, and there's really profound effects on human beings, but then in turn animals are being transformed, they're suffering, sometimes they're being sort of celebrated, they're animals themselves are actually sort of enjoying new opportunities sometimes because of these historical processes.
Certainly aren't our attitudes about animals really totally driven by our environment? I mean, a Montana rancher's attitude versus an urban academic's attitude.
Yeah. I mean, to a large extent, these relationships are driven by our surroundings, by the sort of concrete experiences we have with these creatures. But one of the points I want to try to make in this book is that when we think about human-animal relationships, and in particular when we think about how we should relate to animals and what sorts of changes maybe we should make in our relationships with animals, that those aren't simply ethical questions, but that's actually a historical question, that we need to have some understanding of where our present-day relationships, where these contradictions, for instance, between the fact that we have one category of animals that we call pets and we often treat them like family members. We have another category of animals that we call livestock that at this point are sort of, industrialized. And we feed one category of animal to the other category of animal. And I think we need to know more about how those systems, how those ideas, how those practices developed.
You do also draw parallels somewhat, at least explore the relationship of slavery and the treatment of Native Americans to our treatment of animals.
Yeah, well, in the case of slavery, I think there's a very long history dating back actually to a lot of the early writings and speeches by African American fugitive slaves, critiquing slavery for treating people like animals. There's this longstanding tendency in sort of ethical debates to make this equation between slaves and animals. And in sort of present day discourse around things like, veganism, for instance, oftentimes people today will point to slavery as an example of, here's something that we used to do. We realized it was wrong. We abolished slavery. And so slavery often stands as kind of an example, a sort of object lesson to people in the animal rights movement. But what I'm actually more interested in is looking at how actual slaves and actual animals interacted. And I'm interested in trying to track this actually from the African origins of enslaved peoples in the New World all the way through emancipation.
And what are you finding?
Well, really, really fascinating stuff. I mean, animals are everywhere in history, of course. And this is sort of one of the larger points of the book, right? If we look around our world today, if we think about our own lives, animals are everywhere. But when you open most history textbooks, there's only a few places where animals really figure in any significant way. So in terms of slavery, slaves are changing hands literally side by side with animals. They're on the same auction blocks oftentimes. They are, many, many slaves worked with draft animals in the fields, oxen, mules. But slaves also, and I think a more interesting part of the story is that slaves often used animals to achieve some kind of autonomy within, an incredibly oppressive system. So there's slaves actually owned animals, which was a contradiction in the Southern legal system. I mean, property can't own property, and yet many masters actually tolerated this system whereby slaves would keep their own chickens, often keep their own hogs. And then slaves who succeeded at poultrying and at hog raising often moved into owning larger animals, cattle, horses, mules. And some of them actually became quite entrepreneurial, even though they were still in bondage. And then when slaves ran away, which was sort of the major form of slave resistance in the United States, I would argue, there was this sort of back and forth where the master class would use horses and dogs to try to track slaves down. But then many slaves were able to use their own animals or their own knowledge of animals to get away and to survive while they were escaping.
The contradictions that we have in regards to our relationship to animals is something that the animal rights movement thinks we should resolve.
I don't think that – I mean, the contradictions are so many and they're so deeply entrenched that that resolving them collectively, I think, is something that's sort of, you know, beyond our capacity in the short term without major transformations in, you know, everything from our food systems to the ideas we carry around in our heads. I don't think these are contradictions that can actually be ironed out in any sort of, you know, period of decades even. Certainly individuals perhaps can try to resolve these contradictions in their own lives, but what sort of impact that has on larger systems sort of remains to be seen.
Great topic for a book, though.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of fun to research and to write.
Well, I look forward to reading it. I've been speaking with environmental historian Dr. Thomas Andrews, whose new book is called An Animal's History of the United States, A Work Still in Progress. Thanks very much for giving us a preview.
Oh, thank you.